On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The nation is still reeling from the Virginia Tech massacre, the deadliest school shooting in U.S. history. Meanwhile, a new, more conservative Supreme Court makes an historic decision to uphold a federal ban on one type of abortion. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez fights for his job during a rough-and-tumble Senate hearing. And Baghdad sees a wave of deadly bombings despite the U.S. military surge. Up next, On Point, we'll go inside these headlines with top analysts and our own Jack Beatty and you. We have a terrific panel with us today. Joining us from Charlottesville, Virginia, Dahlia Lithwick. She's senior editor and legal analyst for the online magazine Slate. She was at the Senate hearings yesterday to hear the testimony of Attorney General Gonzalez. Nice to have you with us, Dahlia.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Also with us today from Stanford, California, Todd Lindbergh, longtime columnist for the Washington Times and a fellow at the Hoover Institution, Stanford University. Todd penned his final farewell column this week for the Washington Times after more than a decade of writing. His forthcoming book is called The Political Teachings of Jesus. Todd, nice to have you with us.
Hi, Jane. Good to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, our own Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst and senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you as always.
Hello, Jane, Dahlia, and Todd.
I'd like to start off with the shootings this week at Virginia Tech. On Tuesday, President Bush attended the convocation ceremony there at Virginia Tech with Laura Bush, and he spoke to hundreds of people still shocked in the aftermath of the shooting.
It's impossible to make sense of such violence and suffering. Those whose lives were taken did nothing to deserve their fate. They were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. Now they're gone, and they leave behind grieving families and grieving classmates and a grieving nation.
Jack Beatty, let's start off with you, your thoughts this week as this terrible story unfolded.
Well, three quick points about prevention. One, anyone who wants to do what they can to prevent this sort of thing from happening again should contact their legislators about a bill now in the Congress sponsored by Carolyn McCarthy of New York, whose husband, of course, was killed in an incident in 1993 on the Long Island Railroad. And this bill would require states to essentially combine their mental health records with their background check systems for guns. And, of course, if Virginia had had such a system, this man's brush with the mental health, his mental health background would have come into play. And not only that, but the bill provides funds for the states to do it. The second point is, if people who want to prevent it from happening again should talk to a hunter and should just say, look, you've got your right to hunt and it's great. But this group, this organization that represents you, the gun lobby, is scaring you to death. That sensible gun laws aren't going to come and take away your shotgun or limit your right to use your rifle. We've got to, essentially separate this, I think, really threatening organization from its membership. I think that's a very, very important thing to start doing one hunter at a time.
Todd Lindbergh, let me turn to you about the gun use and Virginia campus officials. Did they do enough to heed the warning signs of this troubled young man and his past?
Well, I think the answer to that is demonstrably not. The problem with this guy, I think, was pretty clear. And what's been astounding, actually, in the days since is just how much we've learned about how much various authorities, from campus to local mental health to police, actually knew. And under those circumstances, it's quite shocking that more wasn't done. And I think that that's going to be increasingly a kind of focus of investigation, of inquiry, and frankly of recriminations also.
It appears that there were plenty of warning signs that Cho was indeed a very troubled young person. Cho roommate Joe Aust spoke with ABC News this week and said that Cho was completely uncommunicative as a roommate.
He pretty much never talked at all. I tried to make conversation with him earlier in the year when he moved in, like asking him, you know, the general questions like, what's your major and like, what year are you? Trying to just carry on a conversation or whatever. And he would just give one word answers and stay quiet. and pretty much he never looked me in the eye.
Lucinda Roy, who was Cho's creative writing professor, said that she found his writing alarming and that she notified other faculty members and the police.
I just felt that he was a very depressed student and seemed to be angry about some things. And so I felt that there were some things that I needed to do to try to make sure that I reached out to him and found out more, because that's what you're meant to do as a teacher.
Dahlia Lithwick, can you ever really protect against this kind of violence?
Well, I have to agree with Todd on one point, which is I think that, you know, it's clear this kid was in the system. This wasn't, you know, a Klebold or a Harris who was just sort of under the radar. He was in and out of the mental health system, you know, in and out of counseling. Campus security had dealings with him. So this isn't someone that we can say, oh, you know, nobody saw it coming. This is someone who his entire class was afraid to show up because they were so freaked out by his plays. So I think the question, and I think Todd's question is a good one, you know, what happened? We had ample notice. We had red flags. But I also want to agree with something that Jack said from the outset, which is, you know, the difference between two murders in this case and 32 was a gun. And I think we need to be clear about that. And it seems to me that if this had been an act of terrorism, if some foreigner had come in and gone on a shooting spree, we'd be falling all over ourselves to legislate, to pass bills, to, you know, understand, to affect change. But there seems to be this sort of tone, this sort of theme in the rhetoric that we're hearing that is, well, you know, he was here legally, he had his guns legally. That's, you know, the price we pay for freedom in this country. You know, that's what it means. You know, we have to lose a few people to keep our guns. And I think that's abhorrent. I mean, I think that's something we need to get beyond and to talk about. If this had been a terrorist, we'd be freaking out right now about what went wrong. And instead we're saying, well, we did our best. You know, maybe next time we'll catch him earlier.
I'd like to get your thoughts also on staying on this topic of the media coverage of the shooting and the killer himself. On Wednesday night, NBC News anchor Brian Williams announced that the network had received a package from Cho Sung-hui.
Tonight, NBC News has received a multimedia manifesto from the gunman at Virginia Tech, including his last recorded words.
I didn't have to do this. I could have left. I could have fled, but now I will no longer run.
Todd Lindberg, what about the media coverage of this shooting? Did NBC make the right decision in airing this manifesto? Virginia State Police said they were disappointed by the network's decision.
Well, yeah, I understand the police have their agenda. I think the news media has a different agenda. Now, what if I found offensive about it was not the airing of it, but frankly the hyping of it. And I think that came through very, very clearly in your clip. You've got the music kind of under, and you've got the dramatic tone and the presentation and all that. I mean, surely there is a better way of doing that still allows the information to come out. By the way, I was completely upbraided on this point at a conversation in my home with my 13-year-old daughter, who thought it was just appalling that this stuff was being put on the air. And so I actually think, you know, in that scenario, I'm afraid I come out a bit of a First Amendment purist. I think that this is information. It's there. You know, yes, it was done for the purpose of showboating. Yes, it was done to make a kind of a broader statement even than that contained in the act of killing 32 people. But nevertheless, you know, I don't see on what basis you suppress it.
Jack Beatty, did NBC cross the line? What is the line between news and exploitation?
I don't know what the line is. I just think how that must have felt to the families of these victims to have to watch that. I just think that was awful.
And Dahlia, is there a danger in showing these tapes over and over again, in giving the killer a forum, if you will, from the grave, glorifying him, even providing a blueprint for copycat?
Absolutely. I mean, think about it. Even in his tapes, even in his writings, he mentioned Klebold and Harris. You know, this is a guy who wanted to be the next, you know, big thing. I heard someone say yesterday, I thought it was a nice point on the radio, that this is sort of a Super Bowl for psychopaths, you know, that this was massive, riveted television attention, and every single person in the country who harbors the kinds of sort of violent revenge fantasies and the notion of getting famous for doing it just got a roadmap to how to get there. So it seems to me that, you know, it does inspire copycats. And I think the other concern, which is a very real concern, is that it deadens you. It does begin, you know, after you hear it, you know, and I confess that the clip you just played, I've heard 6 times now. You can't react anymore. And isn't that in itself a sort of pathology, that you get so inured to it that it loses its power over you? So I you know, I'm a First Amendment purist too, Jane, but I have to say, you know, I'm not a purist when it comes to the networks playing something that needed to be played twice, you know, 2,000 times over the course of the day.
I'd like to turn to the Supreme Court this week. Its abortion ruling upheld a federal ban on so-called partial birth abortion. Here's Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican from Utah, speaking with reporters about Wednesday's ruling.
An overwhelming case was made that this procedure was not necessary, and it was a barbaric procedure.
Eve Gardner, attorney with Planned Parenthood, says the Supreme Court leaves little room for other medical options for women.
Despite all of this overwhelming evidence, the court upheld the law without a health exception. And as a result, there's no doubt that some women in this country will endure very serious harms because they do not have access to the safest abortion procedure for them.
Dahlia Lithwick, I'll turn to you first. What does this ruling say about the changing composition of the Supreme Court?
I think it says everything about the changing composition of the court. The most important thing to remember is that the court heard substantially the same case about a significantly similar, if not almost identical, ban out of Nebraska in 2000. And the different court, with O'Connor on the court instead of Samuel Alito, and with Chief Justice Rehnquist on the court instead of now Chief Justice Robert, decided the opposite thing. They struck down the ban. So, you know, it's impossible to attribute the difference to anything but the change in the court. And what's really curious about the opinion that came down this week is that Justice Anthony Kennedy, writing for the majority, for the five justices in the majority, doesn't even really attempt to differentiate the two cases. I mean, he sort of pays lip service to saying, oh, this one's a little different, this ban's a little different, this one passes muster. But what was astonishing is, if you're going to do something that dramatic and say, oh, you know, the case from 7 years ago is no longer the law, I think you need to do some yeoman's work to distinguish the cases. And he didn't do much of that at all.
Jack Beatty, your response?
Well, Dahlia was there, and she must have heard Justice Ginsburg reading some of her dissent. The Times today quotes someone as saying that Kennedy's opinion was an attack on Justice Ginsburg's entire life. And, you know, reading her dissent, what strikes you is she keeps citing the records of the lower courts, which did a lot of fact-finding about this act of Congress. And, for example, it found that none of the 6 physicians who testified before Congress on this act had ever performed this operation. It found that the claim made in the act and affirmed by Justice Kennedy that this procedure was never medically necessary was in fact not sustained by medical opinion at all. It found the lower courts found that Congress continually disregarded the government's own witnesses in writing this law, the witnesses which brought out that the circumstances under which this particular procedure was necessary. So it's striking just to see and these district courts had a much longer hearing on these things than the Supreme Court and even than the Congress. And I would recommend to any of our listeners, just look at her opinion and see all the things that she's quoting from these lower courts that seem to contradict that show the law to have been roughly and carelessly put together, and that really put Justice Kennedy's majority opinion, I think, in a bad light. But I'm wondering, Dahlia, what that must have been like when Justice Ginsburg started to read her opinion.
I have to confess, I wasn't in the court because I was preparing for an argument. I thought I was going to cover that afternoon, but I will say that the folks who were there, and you know, we should bracket this and say first of all that it's very rare for justices to read their dissents from the bench. They only do it when they're extremely distraught. So that's right. You know, it was quite an extraordinary thing. But from the reporters that I've talked to later, this was as upset as Ginsburg has ever been. I mean, nobody has seen her this wrecked. And you need to understand, I think Jack makes the point nicely, you know, this comes at the end of this entire career that's devoted to women's issues and women's freedoms. You know, as an attorney long before she was a justice, this was something that was so dear to her heart. And earlier this year, not coincidentally, she said quite publicly, and again, very, very rare for her, that she missed having O'Connor on the court because she feels like the men on the court just don't get it in some fundamental ways. So this was more than just a sort of ideological difference. This was a real break from what she thought, you know, the direction of the law was, the bargain in Casey, the bargain after Roe. And she was as, from what I'm told, and again, from reading her dissent, as distraught as she could possibly be.
Todd Lindbergh, what's your voice on this?
Well, in the first place, I must disagree with one point I think that Dolly was making, which is that the court has a very pronounced tendency over time to backtrack without explaining precisely what it's doing. And sometimes that's because of a change in composition on the court. But I mean, if you look at the First Amendment jurisprudence, you know, it's a mess. And it's very difficult to look at the church-state cases, for example, and find a coherent thread through that. So, I mean, you know, let's not idealize the institution. Second point, yeah, I think the composition of the court has changed, and that is the reason this ruling went this way. There's no question about that. I think that this will do nothing except elevate the extent of to which confirmation battles over Supreme Court justices are now real barn burners, huge episodes, huge political battles. And I think that in turn goes to what is, you know, in a way the fundamental question. And that is, would we be having these kinds of battles if we were still deciding these things by legislative means?
Let me ask you this question. What does it say about the possibility of further legal challenges just on the base level of overturning Roe v. Wade?
Well, overturning Roe v. Wade, you see, I could be wrong. And, you know, if a number of additional conservative justices make it onto the Supreme Court, you know, maybe there would be sentiment for that. Certainly, certainly Justices Scalia and Justice Thomas indicated that they thought that there is no constitutional foundation for Roe. And that is not an uncommon opinion. But what the question, though, is really, are there going to be additional efforts to circumscribe, I mean, to essentially put restrictions that don't amount to unlawful restrictions on the ability to obtain an abortion? You get to questions like waiting periods and notification issues, those kinds of things. And the answer to that is clearly yes. There's no question about that that's going to happen. But the other thing that has happened, and, you know, of course, you know, politics is a factor, is we now have a Democratic majority in the House of Representatives. I don't think that in the House of Representatives, if you're the majority, you're the majority. You decide what's going to be on the floor and what isn't going to be on the floor. And surely there is not going to be the desire to conveniently queue up these kinds of challenges that as there was in the past.
Jack Beattie, Adalia Lithwick, final response on this?
Well, you know, just looking again at Justice Ginsburg's dissent, she notes that the court admits that moral concerns are at work here, that, in other words, this particular procedure is so heinous that it's immoral. That's the way Justice Kennedy framed it. But she says that, you know, allowing such concerns to carry the day in case overruling fundamental rights, the court dishonors our own precedent. And she quotes back at Justice Kennedy a line of his from the Texas gay rights case, where she said, where Kennedy said, our obligation is to define the liberty of all, not to mandate our own moral code.
Let's turn to the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings for just a moment. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez testified there this week. Gonzalez and Senator Arlen Specter, Republican of Pennsylvania, they go back and forth here in the clip you're about to hear about the depth of Gonzalez's involvement in the firing of those eight federal prosecutors. Gonzalez maintaining that he had a limited role.
I had knowledge that there was a process going on.
Well, were you involved in it?
Senator, with respect to Carol Lamb, for example.
Were you involved in the process?
I was involved in the process, yes, sir.
Were you involved to a limited extent only?
Yes, sir.
How much more could you have been involved than to be concerned about the replacement of Cummings and to evaluate Lamb and to be involved in Iglesias? Now, we haven't gone over the others, but is that limited in your professional judgment?
In another exchange, Senator Specter tells Gonzalez that he faces a tough road ahead in the Senate committee hearings.
As I see it, you come to this hearing with a heavy burden of proof to do three things. First, to reestablish your credibility. Second, to justify the replacement of these United States attorneys. And third, to demonstrate that you can provide the leadership to the United States Department of Justice.
Dahlia Lithwick, I was told you were at the hearings yesterday. Was Gonzalez believable?
Oh, God. It was a sad day for Gonzalez. He really, I'm looking on my computer at Byron York in the National Review calling it a disastrous day. I mean, and you know, listening to Arlen Specter there, listening to Tom Coburn, listening to Lindsey Graham. I mean, these are real Republicans, you know, rock rib mm-hmm. Republicans who are turning on him. So this was, you know, don't even get me started on what you know, Durbin and Schumer did to him. And,
was anybody coming to his defense?
Orrin Hatch, I think Orrin Hatch went easy on him. But what was really astonishing was that, you know, in some ways you expected the Democrats to be almost overheated, and some of them were, although I thought some of them did a good job. But what was amazing was the sort of calm, surgical way that the Republicans on the committee eviscerated him. I mean, it was almost more brutal, not just because it was coming from the political right, but because they were just surgical. You know, Lindsey Graham said, it sounds like you're making these, you know, pretextual justifications after the fact. You know, Tom Coburn said, if you were to be judged by the standards you use to judge and then sack your staff, we would, you know, sack you. You can't meet that standard. I mean, these are brutal indictments. And that was really the breathtaking thing. At some point, you just had this sense of him wild-eyed, looking for someone to throw him a line. And I think, you know, in fairness, Gonzalez, for someone who's been preparing ostensibly for weeks for this event, just seemed to have no command of the facts. I mean, it was almost as though he weren't aware of the fact or the extent to which he was on trial here. And, you know, where you expected him to say, okay, David Iglesias, you know, former U.S. attorney from New Mexico, boom, 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 this is what he did wrong. Here's the papers. Here's the documentation. He just had vague sort of half answers, no better answers than he had 2 months ago about why these folks were sacked. And that was just quite stunning.
Gonzalez said he misspoke, that mistakes were made. Are there still inconsistencies about what those mistakes were, Todd Lindbergh?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of inconsistencies. But overall, what you've got is essentially a guy who doesn't seem – there are two possibilities, right? Either he's not being candid about the extent of his involvement, or he's not running in the Justice Department. Neither of those is an especially attractive possibility. And, you know, when you look at a situation like this – now, admittedly, the Bush administration has managed to get through 6 years without facing an antagonistic congressional majority, opposition congressional majority. But at the same time, you would think that in the attorney general, you would have somebody who would be a little more capable of addressing questions that are tough, that are coming from senators. It is a complete meltdown, and I don't see. Yeah, I'm frankly been surprised that he's been able to hang on as long as he has. I don't know what it takes. Does it actually take you know, a dozen Republican senators knocking on the door of the White House and saying, yeah, this has just gone on long enough. It's time for him to go, or what?
Well, I think the White House was sending him some signals. CNN was quoting, quote, senior White House aides saying that his testimony was going down in flames. Another one said it was like watching the clubbing of a baby seal. This is from senior White House aides.
These are his friends.
Yeah, these are his friends, right, right. Yeah. I think Todd is right. He had two choices. He could say, I am the cat's paw of Karl Rove, and we did this partly for political reasons, because we wanted to put pressure on these Democrats in these elections, and partly for other reasons. Or he could depict himself as an empty suit, and I think he chose the empty suit. And you're right. Do we want a profoundly empty suit running the Justice Department? To me, the moment that really stood out, and Talking Points memo brings this out today, is when he said that he recognized that prosecutions for voter fraud can have a chilling effect on keeping minorities from voting, and that he was sensitive to doing these kinds of investigations before elections when they could have a chilling effect. Well, of course, as Joe Rich, the former chief of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, has written, in fact, in Missouri, something like that happened. The U.S. attorney there brought 4 of these voter fraud indictments against members of an organization representing poor and minority people, and precisely what before the election. Precisely what the Attorney General said his department was sensitive to and wouldn't do. And of course, voter fraud, as we're learning, is a phantasmal talking point on the part of some of these Republicans. It's a trivial problem.
We're talking about the week in the news. Among all the heartache and high-stakes decisions, it's also been a week of record highs, high speeds, and big prizes. The Dow Jones hit a new high watermark on Wednesday and continued to soar yesterday.
It was one for the history books on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials closed at a new record high thanks to strong earnings from J.P. Morgan Chase and Intel.
With a flurry of last-second tax filings, some filing software like TurboTax had big problems, and the IRS actually pushed back the deadline for some people. Here's a TurboTax spokesperson.
We're seeing the tax season get later and later in the year, and more procrastinators. So the combination of consumers as well as accountants who, would drop off batch filings for their many customers just put strains on the system.
I'd like to turn for a moment to Iraq, a deadly week there in Baghdad. Iraq's ambassador to the United States reacted on Wednesday to a wave of car bombings which killed more than 200 people. He said the bombings should not be interpreted as a sign that the new Baghdad security plan is not working.
The dead were not caused by the security plan, but they were caused by terrorists. And precisely because we were making progress, sectarian violence has come down, and the terrorists are bent on reigniting sectarian violence. We are making progress on the ground. People are turning against al-Qaeda.
Here's another assessment. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Democrat of Nevada, speaking about a meeting he had Wednesday with President Bush about the war funding bill. Reid made news by saying that Iraq is in not such good shape.
I believe, myself, that the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and you have to make your own decision as to what the President knows, that this war is lost.
And here's this perspective from someone on the ground. Ahmed, a Baghdad resident and witness to the aftermath of this week's market bombings, told NPR on Wednesday that the security plan is only making matters worse.
The checkpoints are just making larger crowds and more casualties, Ahmed says. The Iraqi soldiers aren't searching the cars. They just seem to be directing traffic.
Dahlia Lithwick, is the surge working?
No, I don't know that anyone thinks it is. I think, it's interesting. Here's Defense Secretary Robert Gates telling the Iraqi government that, quote, the clock is ticking. I don't think anyone thinks that anything other than figuring a way out is the answer here.
Todd Lindbergh, what do you think?
Well, there were some indications over the past few weeks that the security situation was improving in terms of the sectarian violence, et cetera. That's true. It's also true that Al-Qaeda isn't going away. And so they are, I think they've, in essence, you should forgive the expression, risen to the occasion, which is to say that they know that with security plan, the surge in process, that if they can nevertheless manage to pull off some fairly spectacular attacks, that is indeed going to undermine the effort to get a grip on the situation here. And then again, I'm overall struck by the kind of tragedy of a security plan for Baghdad, that had it been implemented 18 months or so before, or 2 years even, rather than allowing the downward spiral of violence to continue, we might possibly be having a different kind of conversation today. But that said, Petraeus has said that it's kind of an August timetable for knowing where we stand, and I think that's right. It's possible that that things will improve, but you got to say it's not terribly likely at this point.
Jack Beatty, Dahlia made mention of Defense Secretary Robert Gates saying the clock is ticking in Iraq in a practical sense. What does that mean?
He also made a remark that effectively said that the Democrats are putting useful pressure on this government putting their deadlines into that bill. And of course, in Baghdad, he had to make the obligatory comment that progress is being made. Someone remarked that if this is progress, I'd hate to see what deterioration looks like. Mm.
Let's go to the phones. Lots of people calling about Alberto Gonzalez. Todd from Lincoln, Massachusetts, you're on the air. Todd, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thank you. What's your question?
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I realize you've moved on to another topic here, but I'm curious to know and to ask your panelists why it is that so little attention, relatively, is being paid to the use by Karl Rove and others in connection with the Attorney General, with the U.S. Attorney firings, their use of private email accounts at the Republican National Committee. It would seem to me that the use of private accounts to transact public business could be for no other purpose than to conceal their activities. And now the some 4 to 5 million of these emails have disappeared or have been purged. I'm wondering how widespread this kind of practice is, what it indicates about the level of secrecy in the government, who ordered the destruction of these emails, and what this means about the exercise of power in connection with this.
Todd, thank you. Dahlia Lithwick, do you want to answer that?
My sense is that they it's not that they're not making anything of it. I mean, I think that there was a hue and cry. I think that they're not quite sure what to do about it yet. It was interesting, I thought, yesterday that Gonzalez, sort of as a throwaway line in his testimony, suggested that even RNC emails sent on RNC accounts, if they were dealing with government business, were, as he said, sort of presidential records and might be privileged. So I thought that was sort of an interesting statement. That they keep asserting that these documents, even if they were on outside accounts and deliberately created to sort of get around the reporting laws, might be privileged. So he's sort of getting his soundbite out there. But I do think that the larger problem is that I'm not sure that Democrats quite know what to do about it yet. You sort of have this dog ate my homework excuse, and you ridicule it as it should be ridiculed. But I think that the answer is they know that this is serious. My sense is they don't quite know what to do with it. This attorney scandal is discreet sort of bird in the hand scandal. They know where to go with it. But I may be wrong.
Johnny, with another perspective from Harwinton, Connecticut. Johnny, you're on the line.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is really about the Gonzalez case. And let's say this is a worst case scenario for Alberto Gonzalez and he does resign. Then what? I think it was Senator Leahy who brought out the point that in the past it's taken 2 years or more to serve the subpoenas and get people to come and appear before their committee, and with less than 2 years left in his administration, where does that leave us?
Thank you, Johnny. Todd Lindbergh, do you want to respond?
Well, I think if Gonzalez goes, the other thing that you really get into would be the fight over who's going to replace him, and what kind of a nominee for attorney general could the White House come up with who would be able to be confirmed by the Senate, and under what circumstances? Those are pretty interesting questions too. I take Johnny's point to be that we're not going to get to the bottom of this in time to impeach him, that's probably true. But it's an indication of how high the sentiment is running out there. But I think at this point that would be a pretty foolish thing for Democrats to become fixated on. We're going to have an election not so long from now, as we all know, and people get a chance to elect a successor one kind or another. And I think maybe that it would probably be better, notwithstanding the need to investigate this this and that, to keep focused on that as the political accountability mechanism.
Before we go to another call, here's another clip from Senator Patrick Leahy, as he's been mentioned in this conversation, in an exchange with Alberto Gonzalez this week.
See, part of my problem is we've had a number of statements about the dismissal of these 8 U.S. attorneys. I just want to know which one is the accurate one. Your January 18 testimony, your March 7 op-ed in USA Today, or your March 13 press conference, or your March 26 interview with Pete Williams on MSNBC, or your written testimony that is submitted in advance today, or your live testimony here today. Which one is the one we should grab hold of and say, this is the accurate statement, this is the one we can go to the bank with?
Jack Beatty, you wanted to jump in?
Well, I was just going to say that there's some speculation that Orrin Hatch, who really was the only friend Gonzalez had on the committee yesterday, is auditioning to be his replacement. Certainly, Orrin Hatch has not distinguished himself lately. He, on Meet the Press a Sunday or two ago, he made, I think, something like 3 or 4 flatly incorrect statements about Carol Lam, the San Diego U.S. attorney who was fired. He just completely said things that weren't so about her, and there was no correction. So he's making every effort to say, hey, I'm going to be a loyal team player and then some.
Another call from Augusta, Georgia this time. Walter is on the line. Walter, hello. You're on the air.
Hello, Jane. Thanks for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I just want to make a comment. Something that appears to me, I'm just an average guy working hard here in America, but this is another example, I think, of Bush appointing someone who's unqualified for the job. If you remember during the Katrina hurricane, there was a lot of question about whether the FEMA director was qualified to do his job. And Alberto Gonzalez's testimony yesterday kind of pointed to it. He's not in touch. He doesn't understand the responsibilities of the position he's holding, and therefore probably shouldn't be in that job.
Dahlia Lithwick, Walter, thanks for your call. You were sitting in the hearings. Did you get that sense? He was out of touch?
Oh, I mean, for me, one of the most poignant moments in the hearings was when he said, you know, David Iglesias, the U.S. attorney from New Mexico who was fired, was just, quote, in over his head. And you had this sense of, boy, talk about in over your head. You know, this guy does not have command of basic facts about his employees. So I think Walter nails it. I mean, I think that he clearly, you know, one thing he was really good at all these years was being the president's personal lawyer. And I think he probably shouldn't have quit his day job and taken up the U.S. attorney gig.
Change gears for just a moment before we go to a couple of other calls. News this week sort of went under the radar about President Bush's expansion or desire to expand surveillance laws. Dahlia, you, I know, are up on this.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary proposal to expand FISA, the surveillance law that, as we, you know, all, I think, probably can agree, this president hasn't shown a lot of regard for in the first place. So it's kind of the gall of saying, now I want even more powers under FISA. So there's a proposal to allow targets to include non-citizens who may be believed to sort of possess or transmit or receive information. It was a much more narrow definition of targets before. It would offer immunity to telecom companies who cooperate. And it would also, this is my favorite part, the proposed bill would allow the government to keep information that's collected, quote, unintentionally, whatever that means. So it's a vast broadening of the FISA law. And as you said, it went completely under the radar. And in fact, I think Democrats on the Hill sort of underreacted to it in the wake of everything else that's going on. But this is something we need to have a serious national conversation about.
Back to the phones. Mike is calling from Beverly with his idea about the big story of the week. Jack, Mike, go ahead.
Hello. It's not a big idea. I just wanted to make sure that people don't lose sight of the fact in reacting to what happened at Virginia Tech or at Columbine, for that matter, that a lot of people now are becoming more responsible for their own safety. And I think the fact that, the man was allowed to rampage around for, an hour or more than that,
you know, lends people to think that it's necessary that they take things, not individual anti-matter, into their own hands, but just to protect yourself. I myself am a gun owner in Massachusetts and have been for several years.
Mike, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, do you want to respond?
Well, I guess that's one solution. Have everybody have a gun, and when someone comes in like that, you shoot him. Of course, if everybody has a gun, they're going to start shooting each other over crimes of passion, over dented fenders, over bad days. I don't know that that's the answer. It seems to me that the 80% of Americans who favor mandatory registration of handguns, they've got a better idea. Let's work on making it harder for people like this killer to get a handgun.
Dahlia is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Dahlia, you're on the line. Hello.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to make a point regarding NBC's broadcasting the Virginia shooters material. Mm. And it's really just because, you know, just because we're so fortunate as to have a right to free speech, this does not relieve NBC of the obligation to exercise judgment. I mean, essentially, they allowed themselves to be made into a mouthpiece for this guy and an instrument of glorifying him. I mean, it's really just not good enough to shrug your shoulders and say, you know, essentially inquiring minds need to know. I mean, there's an audience for all kinds of hate. And, I mean, just look at IMUS. But there's a territory between being controlled by the law and being controlled by the market. And it's, you know, self-controlled. And I think they really failed in their obligations.
Dahlia, thank you very much. Anyone want to chime in on that last note before we close up?
Well, I think that was kind of addressed at me, and I don't disagree with that. The tastelessness of the repetition and the dramatic intonation and all that, that's, I think, really what's bugging people. I think what I have a hard time coming to terms with, though, is the idea that somehow this material should not be put out at all, that it should go into some kind of lockbox that people will not have any access to. And I think that raises some additional kinds of problems.
Dahlia Lithwick, final thoughts about this week regarding Virginia Tech or otherwise?
Just that it's a sad, sad, dark week. You know, Blacksburg is 2 hours down the road from us here in Charlottesville. And all I can tell you is I know the country is in shock, but, you know, my town is in shock. The state is in shock. And I hope, as I said at the beginning, that the lesson from this is to do something and not shrug our shoulders and say, well, it's the price of having a gun in this country. That can't be the answer.
Jack Beatty, final word.
Well, you know, for a long time, the great line of William Butler Yeats that people quoted was, the center cannot hold. But I think more and more another line from that same poem applies. The ceremony of innocence is drowned in blood.
Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, Senior Editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Thank you, Jack, very much.
Thank you.
Dahlia Lithwick, joining us from Charlottesville, Virginia, Senior Editor and Legal Analyst for the online news magazine Slate. Dahlia, good to have you with us. Thank you for your comments.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
And Todd Lindbergh, joining us from Stanford, California, longtime columnist for The Washington Times. Great to have you with us as well, Todd. Thank you.
Glad to be there, Jane.
Thanks. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.